You are listening to 89.5 FM KOPN Columbia, Mid-Missouri's source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and music of the world. It is so much more than radio. It is your community radio on the web at kopn.org. And this is Speaking of the Arts. Good morning and welcome to Speaking of the Arts, Mid-Missouri's only in-depth weekly art show. My name is Diana Moxon. Thank you for joining me. Each of the branches of the arts faces the challenge of these times a little differently. Going to galleries ranks as a pretty safe activity, visiting a cinema is in the middle of the pack, and singing in a choir is at the high risk end. A theatre and live music rank somewhere in between, but definitely towards the end of things we should not be doing right now, or at least not indoors. And yet so much innovation, creativity and art continues to happen. Last weekend, Talking Horse Productions braved the heat and held an afternoon and evening of improv and music at the Stevens Lake Park Amphitheatre, and it felt so good to be back at a live performance with other people, all safely distanced apart. The actors wore face shields and stayed the recommended distance away from each other, and yes, it was a bit weird to start off with, but 5 minutes in and it all seemed normal. This week, the University of Missouri Theatre Department releases a new production called So Near, So Far, a musical review written by composer Brett Christopherson and filmed on stage at the university's Rheinsberger Theatre, with incredible logistical detailing to keep all the actors and crew safe. The amount of energy that organisations and arts makers are putting into creating content for us is huge, and they are largely doing all of this in a strange void. A void where there is no audience feedback, no sound of applause, no laughter, no wave of energy coming from a packed auditorium of expectant people. And the big question for all arts organizations as they face the long haul on this new world of distancing is, how do we keep our audiences engaged? On today's show, arts management consultant Sarah Leonard chats about audience engagement and how our audiences are changing during this time. And director Joy Powell and composer Brett Christopherson talk about their production, So Near, So Far. And a quick note for anyone thinking, wasn't the intro music different today? Yes, well spotted. I am a huge fan of the guitarist Yasmin Williams. Yasmin was on the show back in March and played as one of the true false buskers. She was also here last fall for the Dismal Niche Experimental Music Festival. So I reached out to her and I asked if she would be happy for me to play her Restless Heart song as part of the introduction and closing for the show. And she happily said yes. Restless Heart is from her Unwind album, which you can find on Spotify. And she has a new album, as yet unnamed, coming out later this year. So, on with the show. Our first stop today is with Sarah Leonard. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
So usually on the show, we are talking to people who are in shows or making art or on the stage, and also more recently, arts organization directors who are trying to work out how to fulfill their mission and pay the rent while we have limited or zero access to the arts in real life. So when I saw your note pop up about how the audience we have now is not the same as the audience we had before, I thought it would be great to chat to you and find out what you're hearing from arts organizations across the country about this, as we both call it, this liminal time. So one of your specialties as a researcher and educator is audience building. And it's an area which I think every arts organization talks about. How do we get more people through our doors or into our seats? And I want to start off by going back to a report you co-authored back in 2015 for the National Endowment for the Arts about the barriers and the motivations that affect arts attendance. And I know it's a huge subject. It's a very big report. But tell us a little bit about what that report looked at that previous reports on arts attendance maybe hadn't really delved into.
Well, yes, the report is called When Going Gets Tough, Barriers and Motivations Affecting Arts Attendance, and it came out in early 2015 based on a set of data that's actually was collected in 2012. So at this point, another round of that data has been collected and we're kind of waiting for for the analysis to come. But it was really exciting for those of us who do audience building because it was the first time that we had a nationally representative sample asking what we call attitudinal questions. So why do you do this or why do you not do this? So prior to that, we had had regional studies or qualitative studies asking some similar questions, but we hadn't had something representative. So that was the first exciting thing. The other thing that made this report different is that we were able to isolate this category of what we called interested non-attendees. So the respondents were asked questions about what motivated them to attend live performances or exhibits that they may have attended in the prior year. And then they were also asked about whether there was an exhibit or a performance that they had wanted to attend in the prior year but didn't follow through. So these were folks who said, I wanted to go to the arts, I intended to go to the arts maybe even, but I never actually made it. So those were the people that we asked I didn't ask the questions. I just got the data after they'd been asked. But those were the folks that were asked questions then about barriers, what kept them away. So for the first time, we weren't asking the people who never cared the barrier questions, right? So the analogy I always use is that you could ask me why I don't go to ice hockey games, but I don't really know, to be honest. I've never been. I have no interest in going. So my answer is not that helpful to people that are trying to get more people to go to ice hockey games because I'm just not going to go. So being able to isolate people that were interested but didn't follow through gave us some additional insight into this actually 13.3% of the U.S. adult population that falls into this category. That now when I'm working with organizations, I say, you know, we can work to change the hearts and minds of the masses, but let's start with this 13.3% of the U.S. adult population that says they want to go but haven't followed through. Let's start with getting them in the door. So those were a couple of the things that set it apart. We also made sure to look not just at the general headline data and at demographic groups, which we did because you sort of need to, and to compare it to other reports that was necessary. But we also broke things down by life stage because we found that maybe age was less important than whether you had children under 6 in the house, or age was less important than whether you were an empty nester or retiree. So we were able to use some of the other data available to correlate those things and get sort of a different way to slice the pie.
One of the things that I think is really interesting from this from the report you did is that it wasn't about cost. Cost was only a consideration for a certain portion of people. And for those people, it was very important. But I think often in arts organizations, we think that, you know, is it the ticket price that's getting in the way? And that really wasn't the case. What did you find out about that?
That's right. I think we often overblow cost. And in fact, we often overblow those practical barriers to participation, when in reality, it's perceptual barriers that keep people away more of the time. What we found is that the number one cited barrier to participation was time. But simultaneously, we found that the American Time Use Survey was telling us that people might have 5 hours of free time a day. So it's possible that your free time is at 7 a.m., which does little good for an arts organization most of the time. But I think what it really pointed us to is that it's not strictly about time, and it clearly isn't strictly about cost. What it's about is value. What it's about is arts organizations making it worth people's time, which kind of brings us to audience development, right? Our job then becomes communicating to people the value of what we're doing to what they already care about. There's a book called The Art of Relevance that I use with my students a lot that talks about making it about bacon, right? When you suddenly equate something to bacon, people care a lot because they want to eat their bacon, right? So how do we make the arts about their bacon, right? What is it? What interests and values do they already have that mesh with the interests and values of our organizations so that we can be making meaningful connections with individuals as actual people, which is what audiences are made up of, which I think sometimes we forget. You know, we think of them as these big monoliths, but it's just a bunch of human beings. We also found that the number one reason people go to the arts is for socializing, time with family and friends. And some studies have come out since then that reiterate that and also point to a desire just to have fun. So how can we speak to those needs and those desires as well? But yeah, I think in terms of the barriers, it's really not so much about cost. I think we like that answer sometimes as arts organizations because it's something we can control to a point, and then we can say, well, we just can't change it anymore. We like barriers that are about things like location or time because they feel out of our control, so we can throw up our hands and not address them. But I think really at the end of the day, it's about how do we make this sufficiently valuable that it's the way someone chooses to spend their time in a way that matters to them, not so much about us.
And also from that report, when you looked at non-Hispanic Blacks and African Americans, it was also about their sense of community, supporting things that were meaningful to them and their community. And I think that talks a lot about where we are in this current moment of recognizing that there is too much systemic racism within the arts, as within many industries. And how do we overcome that if we're not providing programming that speaks to our Black and brown communities, and yet what's important to them is supporting the communities. It's a two-way dialogue that support them. How can we engage that audience? Talk a little bit about what you found about that component within the barriers and motivations.
Absolutely. And I wish I had all of those statistics fresh in my mind. I don't completely, but I had a funny feeling this was going to come up because I think it is such a critical component right now. You know, we can talk about how we engage audiences during COVID, but COVID is not happening in isolation. And I think we need to recognize that the zeitgeist is shifting. There's a mandate that we have had for a long time, but there's sort of a renewed attention to the systemic racism and white privilege that is so heavily embedded in so many of our cultural organizations. So, you know, we found some really interesting things when you break down the motivation data. As you pointed out, non-Hispanic Blacks and African Americans did most often cite supporting community as a major motivation for attendance at performances in particular. American Indians and Alaska Natives more often cited supporting community as a major motivation for attending exhibits. So we also then had Mexican Americans, American Indians, biracial or multiracial adults saying that they wanted to learn as a greater motivation for attending exhibits. So it is really important, I think, as arts organizations, I hope that we have this renewed sense of call toward our nonprofit mandate, which is to serve our community. And that doesn't mean just the white people in our community. That means our entire communities. So by breaking down this information, I think it gives us a clue. It gives us a jumping off point to say, how do we talk to different parts of our community about what we're doing? It's going to have a programmatic impact, I hope. You know, what are we offering? Whose stories are we telling? Who are we involving? If people want to be supporting their communities, how are we making engaging with us part of supporting your community as opposed to a part of your community you've never felt included in? We get some insights into what matters. And disproportionately, our arts organizations right now are led by white people, both at the board and executive staff level, which is a problem we need to address. And we need to address it in part by making ourselves matter to more of our communities, by providing what they're asking for from their cultural institutions. And I think this can give us some jumping off points into what some of our Black and brown members of our community are looking for that we may not be providing because of our own gaps in perception.
Right. I think it starts with a lot of conversations and listening, and it isn't a quick fix. It's not something that we can do overnight.
Absolutely.
But there are so many things going on right now that it's a tough position to be in as an arts organization director when, you know, you're just trying to pay the rent and keep the doors open. And inevitably, there will be organizations that don't come through this.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess I kind of know the answer to this because it's never happened before, but I mean, in the current landscape that we're in, I think the first few weeks we all thought of this as a temporary situation, but now, you know, it looks like it's much more permanent. We're starting to talk to architects and think about how we're going to design venues to incorporate this new world. But has there been any previous research done that modeled this kind of situation?
Oh, gosh. I certainly couldn't say definitively, but not that I'm aware of. I think for the arts, this is, man, we're used to being all up in each other's faces, right? Particularly in the performing arts, it's literally what we do. There's this prized sense of intimacy that comes in small spaces. There's this grandeur that comes from big casts that are literally on stage spitting on each other, which just is not an option right now. And sweating on each other and jumping around, you know, it's not very glamorous, really, when you think about it that way. I'm not aware, and maybe you are, of research that has helped us model this. And one of the things I'm looking at as I'm talking and working with organizations right now is that, you know, we're just not going to come out the way we came in.
Mm.
I don't think that there is a going back to normal. And I think as a field, we're still a little bit split. There's still a lot of folks who are hoping that we're going to just go back to the way it was. But at least in the medium term, things are going to have to change down to really reworking our financial models, even as organizations, because all it takes is 10% of our audience to be uncomfortable coming back and the old model's not going to work anymore. The margins were so slim that I think that's really going to be critical. I also think, though, that we have an opportunity right now that we've never had before. And maybe this sounds a little bit Pollyanna, but we'd become, I think, as a field, so used to the familiar discomforts of nonprofit cultural life, right? The slim financial margins, the long hours, the specific challenges that we were used to dealing with. And I think this combination of situations, this confluence of events we're having, is forcing us to kind of throw everything up in the air, which means that part of what we have is an opportunity to decide how we are going to put the pieces back together. We're going to be faced with practical realities we haven't had to deal with before. What do we do when we can only sell every third seat in our house? And that's if we're lucky. Can we maintain the same kind of production schedule? Will we ever be able to get back to the same staffing levels we had before? There are all of these administrative questions and practicalities we're going to have to deal with. But, and I think this relates to the diversity and inclusion question as well. How do we want to recreate this? If we're going to be rebuilding our organizations in a strong sense, what do we want them to look like? We can get rid of accepting some of those familiar discomforts and recreate things a bit, which is not an opportunity that comes along very often. So if I'm looking for the silver lining here, to me, that's it. And I think with audience building, we are asking new questions about, or should be asking questions about, how we meet the needs our communities are conveying now, which are different from where they were 6 months ago in a lot of ways, or ways they were meeting those needs have changed. We have the opportunity to open doors to bigger parts of our community by addressing some of those more fundamental needs as well. Sorry, that was a long tangent, but you got me thinking.
Well, that kind of leads into what I was going to ask you, which is, talk to me a little bit about audiences and in what way. You write that audiences are going to be different. They're not going to be the same as the audiences we had before COVID-19. But then there's kind of a caveat to that. It's like, they may be the same people, but their needs and their wants are going to be different. So talk a little bit about that, how audiences are going to change as you see it.
Sure. So I'm seeing it in a couple of different ways. The really tragic reality is that some of our organizations and some communities are going to see a change in the names because some communities are being incredibly hard hit, and we will lose audience members. We will lose donors. And that's heartbreaking and unfortunately also probably realistic. But I think we're also seeing the needs and the expectations of our audiences evolve during this time. When I think about arts organizations, and one of the pitfalls I sometimes see, it's that if you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, just to put it in sort of a familiar way, arts organizations often relegate themselves to the tippy top of the pyramid, up in that self-actualization zone, where I think we're sort of feeding the soul and the spirit, and that's our business. And it is, but part of what the motivation data tells us is that people are actually looking to cultural organizations to fulfill much more fundamental needs in their lives, a desire for connection, a desire to be with people that they love and care about. And I think what's happening during this time is that a lot of people's normal ways of connecting have gone away. And we have some brand new data, actually, just came out last week, put out by LaPlaca Cohen and Slover Linnet Audience Research, freely available online, that shows us quite starkly that this connection is what people are craving. Things they can do with their kids, some other practical needs they need to have met. But what I think we need to be looking at as arts organizations is, what are those needs now? That desire for connection, some of these basic fundamental human needs. We have a different opportunity to fill a void because while there's a lot happening virtually that we are competing with, the organizations that are weathering this the best, I believe right now, are the ones that have a strong connection to their community, where the people know them and they are known. So being able to leverage that to meet some of those emerging needs, I think is really valuable. And because those needs may be being met in fewer places for connection, for community, for opportunities to be creative, a lot more people are getting out their sewing machines and picking up needlework and baking bread. You know, how can we, in a way that is consistent with our mission and respects our capacity, be meeting some of those needs? And we may find open doors to greater segments of our community because those needs aren't being met in other places. Now, that's also going to require us to be in the right places and speaking the right language as well.
I mean, I see that. I see, of course, almost all of my friends have picked up new arts skills, say, whether it's making sourdough bread or knitting. But we are all doing it in isolation. And this idea, I mean, I agree, we're all desperate for socialization, but that's not something that we are able to do. So how do arts organizations navigate that impossibility almost of us being together physically?
I'm seeing it in a lot of different ways, depending on the organization. And it is going to vary, and it's going to come more naturally and easily to some organizations than others. Some are doing it through, I have a client, for example, that is a choral arts organization. And so they're still gathering online to sing, and it's imperfect, and it's awkward, and it's challenging, and it's not quite serving the same purpose it served before. But their folks have said, it's a community choral organization, they've had 400 people sign up to sing together virtually, awkwardly over the summer, far more than they've ever had before, because people do desire to create and they're looking for that connection that they associate with that communal experience. And it's still, they've told me that like the chat just blows up during these rehearsals because the people that are used to seeing each other are having the opportunity to connect, however imperfectly. And mostly what they've heard from folks is just, thank you for doing something. Thank you for being there for us and seeing us and what we need. I think there are other organizations that are able to do it through visual means on social media, which sounds really shallow and basic, but most of us can't shoot the moon right now. Our capacities are severely diminished. So if you put up on social media or provide shareable content that celebrates the ways that your community connects with each other and with the organization, hey, that's the painting I did. that's up on this organization's Facebook right now. Or, hey, that's a picture of a dance class I was in. Cool. I think if you can allow people to hold on to your organization as a way even of connecting with their broader community. So if I share Columbia Art League's post that has my painting in it, I've put Columbia Art League at the center of this connection I want to have with my friends and that sort of thing. So some of these are, it's not maybe the depth that we always crave, but it doesn't have to be elaborate and huge to be meaningful. I think one of the most important things for our organizations to do right now is just keep themselves present in the lives of their people, so that once we know what new normal is, hopefully we've carried some of those folks along with us.
Another issue which I have felt personally challenged by is how many organizations need our financial help. We all have organizations that we support, and as the world is changing, there are new organizations or emerging issues which now I feel more strongly about and that I want to help fund. And so we all have to make financial choices, even more so now maybe than before. So as an arts organization, how do we navigate this wider critical need for funds and the increase in asks that we're getting?
It is a real challenge. I think there are a couple of things. One is, if we don't honor the sort of greater social needs of this moment, we run the risk as coming across as looking very unengaged in our community, very disconnected from the broader needs, and that will not serve us well, right? We need to be finding ways that our values as an organization intersect with the values of our community. And so to just say, well, we're important too, and sort of take the strident defensive approach is probably not going to work very well for us. That being said, I've seen a lot of organizations that have found ways and taken time to call a lot of their people just to check. And by their people, I mean loyal audience members, donors, not to ask directly, but just to check in with them. And in some cases, for those who do have the means, that's yielded significant gifts. We need to recognize that we are not at the top of the pecking order right now as a field. People are concerned about making sure, and rightfully so, that those whose paychecks have been impacted have food on their tables and roofs over their heads. And that's the reality. We know as arts organizations that we are integral to people's lives. We can see it in where people are turning right now for their entertainment and for their connection. They're coming to cultural organizations. And I think that that's something we can talk about. I think it's okay to ask, but it is going to be a challenge. And this is not, you know, popular to talk about. All of our organizations are not going to make it through this. I know of organizations that are having some real heart-to-heart conversations about, should they make it through this? Is their mission that they have had something that is relevant and viable in the foreseeable future? Or do they, you know, stop expending every last red cent now to try to keep the doors open so that in 2 years they can kind of reinvent themselves and come back in a way that's more meaningful to their community, whatever that may look like at the time? And one of the things that's important to remember is that that's actually okay. As nonprofit organizations, our mandate is to serve our community. And sometimes as our communities change, that fit isn't the same anymore. Obviously, I'm not saying I want organizations to shut down, but for some, that may be a reality. The giving thing is hard. Our organizations need it. And I think it's okay to say that. But I think it's also really important that we, even as we're having to change some of the how we connect to people, the language, the messaging we use, the fundamental identity of our organizations needs to remain consistent. And that's going to continue to connect with the people who have connected with our organizations. I think that when we're looking for donors, that's not usually where most people are going to walk in the door to our organization. Those are usually people already connected to the organization. There are exceptions to that, but by and large, when we're talking individual donors. So hopefully there are people we can ask, but I think respectfully and in a way that's very cognizant of what's going on more broadly. I think about the Missouri Symphony's fundraising effort aimed toward compensating the musicians who would have come for Hot Summer Nights, at least a part of what their contract would have paid. While that doesn't bring additional operating revenue to the organization, it is a way to demonstrate the values of the organization, and people responded very strongly to that fundraising effort. So I think it's about how we go about it and the way we position ourselves to really identify ourselves as integral, caring members of the community rather than a source of competition, if that makes sense.
So what are you saying to, I mean, your clients cross all different arts genres. It's not just theater or not just music, but what would you say are the three most important things that an arts organization should be doing right now to survive this liminal time and be ready for the next 12 months?
That's a great question. I think the first one is plan and plan to plan. So we have to be thinking about likely situations. We cannot just sit there and wait for this to pass us by and then pick up and start again. So we need to be imagining what are the possible permutations, and we need to be crunching the numbers, not always the favorite thing of arts administrators to do, but what is going to be possible for our organization, and get our boards involved in that situational planning. I think we also need to be looking for that moment when the fog is going to start to lift enough that we can get a sense of what we may be coming back to, what it may look like, even if it's just what it's going to look like for that first 3 or 6 months. Because most of our planning from pre-COVID is out the window. We may or may not be able to do those programs. The financial models have changed. The budgets have had to go. So we need to be doing the best we can now to iterate in short-term chunks, maybe 3-month chunks, and then be ready to set some new strategy, to think freshly about what does it mean for us to fulfill our mission in this time, what's going to be possible. So I think that's the first one. I think another one in terms of navigating this time and coming out is to remember as an organization, and this is hard when you're in survival mode, but it is not all about you as an organization. It is about serving your community. And when we look at the data that's coming out now about what people want from their cultural organizations right now, nobody's saying, I want more high-profile violinists. Nobody's saying, I want to know why the maestro is so special. They're saying, see me as a person and fulfill my needs. So how can we communicate our service? People are saying, we want to have fun. We want to relax. Help us do that. So filling the needs that people have, looking for those opportunities to create the shared experiences that generate that psychological sense of community in whatever limited ways we can right now, I think, is also going to be big. And then I think the third thing is to recognize, or a third thing, I could probably come up with 25, but a third thing, to go back to some of our earlier conversation, is to recognize that expectations are changing regarding inclusivity in our organization. So not just inviting diverse people in, but actually including them meaningfully in the lives of our organization. So some of the data we have coming out saying right now is that after this is all done, 24% of people indicated that what they wanted is for our organizations to be friendlier to all kinds of people. 18% were saying they wanted more diverse voices and faces. This is something that cannot wait until we're up and running again because of the systemic racism and white privilege that's embedded in so many of our organizations. I think that as we are recalibrating, we need to be working on our intentional inclusivity as arts organizations so that we are prepared to serve more of our communities for many reasons. It will help sustain our organizations. The more of our community we're actually serving, it will help us. But also, that's a role that we have in our communities, and our audiences are going to be expecting that of us. So that's something we need to be addressing meaningfully now to continue to speak to the values and continue to be relevant to our community. So there are three. I don't know if they're the top three, but there are three.
Are you optimistic about the post-pandemic arts world?
I would say I have a mix of both. I think that as I watch so many of my peers and colleagues who are leading organizations struggle, my heart's breaking for them. You know, I actually have the easy job right now as the advisor, right? So I go in and I get to have this critical distance and say, well, here's what I think you should do. But it's not my family on the line in the same way. And it's not the people I've given all of this blood, sweat, and tears to. So my heart's breaking for folks because change is hard. That being said, I do believe that we can find good in news in this. There have been ways that our field has been broken, that we have the opportunity to fix. And what does give me optimism is that we are the creative people, right? This is our job, is living in the world of creativity. And if we can allow ourselves to really exercise that creativity, I believe some amazing work is going to come out of this. We know that amazing artwork often comes out of adversity. The question is, what will our organizations look like to support that work? I do think the field may change. I think what organizations are playing in it are going to change. And I think we're going to be having some conversations as a field about how we rebuild not just individual organizations, but whole community ecosystems of the arts and culture in some places. And that will be hard because change is hard. But I do think that there's a lot of opportunity there. Maybe that's one more thing I would say to organizations, is look for resistance to change in yourselves and your organizations, and try to be able to identify it and work through that discomfort, because it's coming one way or another.
Well, on that vaguely happy note, thank you, Sarah Leonard, so much for chatting to us. That was awesome. And there were so many great ideas that I think will help arts organizations. And I would encourage people to check out your reports that are available through the National Endowment for the Arts website, and Arts Americans for the Arts, I think, is the website where you can find things. But I will post information to that on our Facebook page and our website.
Awesome.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And with no time to lose, let's head on over to the MU Theatre Department next to chat with director Joy Powell and composer Brett Christofferson. Good morning, Brett and Joy.
Good morning.
So it is a tough time to be working in the world of theatre, but this weekend, the second MU Theatre production, or maybe the third MU Theatre production of the summer, opens virtually, a musical journey comprised of theatrical songs by musical director, composer, lyricist, and educator, our guest today, Brett Christofferson, and the show is called So Near, So Far. Now, Joy, you and the MU actors and incredible tech teams have done an amazing job creating a summer season out of a seemingly impossible situation. But out of disruption comes innovation. So I'm wondering what for you are some of the truths in the silver lining of this moment in theatrical history?
Wow, what a question. I love it. Diana, thank you again so much for having us on. It's always a pleasure, sincerely, to share our process with you and what's going on. I'd say the silver linings are to be proved over and over again, or to prove that theater is essential and that the arts are resilient and we will always find a way to tell stories that are important. Also, I think for myself, co-director Scott Kuntz for this particular show, knowing that we had a team, literally a village of people that were working so hard to make this happen. And I think probably the third takeaway is our students will come out of the summer with skills that they never had before and might not have had, not in the same way that they have now for career readiness. Our actors learning how to perform on camera, our camera operators. We have a team of three student video editors that are just absolutely incredible. They have worked unseen hours. You know, just knowing that those skills, learning how to do this in a completely new context, has been definitely a silver lining.
I'm wondering, and maybe Brett, you can talk to this too, as a person with a big theatre background. I mean, when you're an actor or any part of a theatrical production team, and being on the stage and getting that feedback from the audience and getting that energy from the audience is so much part of the joy of the experience for everybody. How does this look going forward? I mean, it could be a year before we really are all back in theaters again. How do you sustain that energy when there's nobody sitting in front of you?
Well, I think to sort of piggyback a little bit on what Joy was just saying, this the innovation, there's a real excitement about that. And when we all went into quarantine and then the theater companies started digging through their archives and putting things up online, and the truth is it will never replace a live experience for an audience or an artist. That will always be unique and special. And I think we all just have to keep remembering that this is temporary. And yes, it might be a year, but this online stuff is a new medium for theater and it can at least get us through. But I do think, moving forward, we'll probably see that this component will remain. And I think it's going to prove to be a really interesting and exciting outlet, especially for new work, because you can do it on a smaller budget, I think. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
Well, Brett, you wear many creative hats, and not all of which need to be worn in public. I mean, you have the beauty of being able to work from home and work quietly. How has the muse of upheaval influenced your creativity over these past few months?
Yeah, that has been very interesting. I don't know, just personally, I am at a certain point in my life, and I lived in New York for 22 years, and I moved back to Missouri, and I wondered about, I just have been sort of in a place where like I'm wondering where I am as an artist, right? But I think exactly what you said, upheaval, it generates energy and artists have to deal with what's going on. And I think as the level of, I don't know what the right words are, the level of activity of the level of what's going on out there, it just feeds the artistic impulse. So as horrible as all of this is, my hope, and I think that we're going to see some very exciting work as this continues to roll out.
I wonder at what point audiences are already, when we have enough distance of time that we can sit down and be in this period as represented on stage without just wincing at the pain of this period.
Right.
Whether that's going to be months or years.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that remains to be seen. I mean, there's a song in the show that does actually deal specifically with the times. I wonder how it's going to age, because there's already lyrics in it that are a little outdated just from even like 6 weeks ago when I wrote it. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't have a great answer for that.
Joy, this is the 51st season, uninterrupted, for the Larry D. Clark Summer Rep Theatre. And had things gone according to plan, you would have had a big production of Beauty and the Beast on right now. So thinking back to those days at the beginning of March when the world just became a house of cards, I mean, what did you think at that point were your options for this whole Summer Rep Theatre?
Well, we weren't sure, but because of Dr. Heather Carver, who's our chair of the theater department and the artistic director for Summer Rep, she and I met, and we just decided that we were going to do something. First of all, Larry Clark and his wife Yvonne, who passed away a few years ago, and their extended family have given generously to make sure that Summer Rep continued. And so we wanted to honor that legacy and that generosity. But we also, everyone gets paid for Summer Rep. It's a job because of that generosity. And so with so many artists being out of work, we knew that our top goal was to keep artists employed. And we had the ability and means to do that. And so that was one of the first things that we talked through, is that, man, we're going to find something that we can keep creating. We're going to make theater. We just don't know what it's going to look like. That's kind of was our beginning thoughts. And then when the rights that we had were not, we couldn't get the streaming rights for Beauty and the Beast, then we said, okay, let's turn to what is possible. And Brett had graciously agreed to let us do a show of his music. And then he has written two new songs for this show. The one he was discussing, The Summer of Our Discontent, and the opening number, There Was a Song. Both of those will be a world premiere in this show. So part of it is that Brett really kind of took a chance on us and said yes. And part of it is just by the sheer will of Heather and I knowing now more than ever, people need content that's valuable, that touches them. I think sometimes, as we keep joking, in these unprecedented times, so much information is happening. So many things are happening. We get overwhelmed and we kind of shut down. There's like a numbness, I think, that can set in. And one of the things that I find so powerful about Brett's work is it always evokes a feeling. It may be laughter. It may be like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. It may be, oh, I feel that emotionally, whatever. But it helps us stay connected to our humanity. And Heather and I felt like now, of course, was the moment when people needed that. And so that's, we just decided that it was going to happen. And then, of course, had, you know, a company of 90 people say yes. And the rest is kind of history on that.
So, Brett, tell me about So Near So Far, how it came about and what it contains.
Well, it contains songs. The oldest song is a song from my very first musical I wrote when I was in college. And so that's about 28 years old. So now you know how old I am. And then, yeah, the newest, of course, were written just a few weeks ago. So all composers kind of have a review that they're, you know, of their work, at least all theater composers, like, you know, Jason Robert Brown kind of started this. He didn't well start it, but, you know, he rejuvenated this trend with Songs for a New World, and all the, you know, the young composers started putting together their own versions of that. And I have one called This Very Moment. So that was in the works. So we kind of tried to steer clear of the songs in that show. So I'll only bring that up to answer your question that, you know, we pick songs that were not in that. So this features a kind of a wide variety of many show specific songs, you know, with lyrics that refer to characters by name in the show. So, but there's still, we hoped and banked on that there would be a universality to it. Did that answer your question?
So tell me a little bit about the arc of the story that is told. I mean, it isn't a musical. It is a review right. of different theatrical songs that you've composed over your career. But you, I presume there is a kind of a storyline arc or a theme that runs through it. So how is it all put together?
Well, when we decided that we were going to go with songs that weren't quite featured in the other, we basically put together a list of songs and let the theme evolve from there. And I think if we had to sum it up, it's, I don't know, I'm going to repeat something that somebody else said about my work. It's, and I think this kind of gets to the point. It's trying to find the extraordinary in the ordinary, that, you know, these are generally about everyday people and everyday moments, and trying to capture what is extraordinary and universal about those moments. Now, there are some, there's like a song that features an actress playing Tammy Faye Baker from a Tammy Faye musical I wrote. There's also a song that features Lizzie Borden. So it doesn't completely adhere to that blueprint, but we're just trying to give a wide spectrum of the human experience, both funny and sad and hopeful. And we hope that audiences will be moved, and hopefully they'll get a good laugh on a few places too.
Joy, were you part of the selection of songs process?
A little bit. The co-director and I, Scott, we both performed Brett's music quite a bit. And we were actually both in the review, which is called This Very Moment, in St. Louis last year. And of course, have been a fan of Brett for a long time. So we, of course, had suggestions. And there were definitely a few songs that we were like, this must be in this show. But really, it was Brett that curated the list. And then Scott and I took the cast of Beauty and the Beast, which was 33 people, and put them into the show. And so that was a challenge. But fortunately, of course, we have 33 very talented people. And so it was really interesting and wonderful to be able to put them in this. And everyone is featured at least once, if not twice. And so it really, I feel really excited and proud about this cast, because I think they've really worked very hard to bring the work to life.
So the last show that you did online, All the Spaces, which was brilliant, and I think it's still available to be viewed on the Theatre Department's YouTube channel, but it was an incredible piece of technical wizardry in that all the actors were filmed at home across the country, and then the MU tech team stitched everyone's individual performances together and added in the audio track. But this production was actually filmed on stage at the Rheinsberger Theatre with all of the issues about social distancing in the middle of a pandemic. So tell me a little bit, Joy, about how you managed to do that staging.
Well, we call it social distance staging. We've coined that phrase. And we had a limit of how many people could be on stage or how many people could be in a dressing room or in the costume shop or in the lobby. And so we posted those rules and we just timed it so that people would come in, our stage management team would take them to the dressing room, they would change into costume, and then they would stay there till it was time to go to the stage. So it was a very intricate plan and schedule. We had face shields and masks, and we just stayed apart. What's great about the Rheinsberger stage is it's large, right? So we really could distance and then do the face shields for, let's say, if someone was putting a microphone on someone. And so we just made it work. And there are three people that are out of town, and they all recorded the way that we did All the Spaces in their homes. And so we've got their footage, and then the fabulous tech team worked their magic and has put together the show. So it wasn't easy, but we made a way.
Are they singing in masks, or they would take the masks off for the actual performance part?
The only time people took their mask off was when we recorded. And they were distant from each other. So if there's more than one person in a scene, they're distant from each other. And then they're distant from the crew. And then they would put the mask right back on in between takes or, you know, when that particular song was done recording.
Well, let's listen to a piece of music from the show. Brett, why don't you introduce it for us?
Sure. This is called This Love. It was from an early review of my stuff, the title song, and it's basically kind of a panorama of the full experience, hopefully, or getting at the full experience of what it's like to be in love from a fairly young perspective, I would say.
Okay, here it is.
Staring at the ceiling, I am frightened by my heart as the shutters try to hide the morning sun. You are sound asleep beside me, and here's the scary part. For the first time, I am not compelled to run. I fell, and like the saying, I fell, and I fell hard. This love just came upon me, and it caught me quite off guard.
I'm checking out the party, and my posture, I assume, says I'm through with all you lousy, low-down men. All at once I hear you laughing from across a crowded room. Then our eyes meet, it's here I go again. I fall and I can't stop it. I'm at my heart's behest. But this love, I have to tell you, is a most unwelcome guest.
This love, it takes me to new heights.
This love, it gives me sleepless nights.
This love, it bites.
This love is pure.
This love will kill me, I am sure.
Central Park in autumn on a Sunday afternoon. I am watching him play football with the boys. And I guess it might sound cheesy, but he still can make me swoon. And he fills me with a million tiny joys. In good times and in bad times, till death do we depart. From now until forever, lover, I give you my heart.
This love, it took me by surprise.
This love, it cut me down a size.
This love left me feeling blue.
This love is wonderful and new. It tells a million stories of rapture and despair. This love in its depths and glories can't
take us there. This love may last a moment. This love may not survive. But here, in this very moment, this love lets me know I'm alive. Alive!
Standing at the mirror, I'm remembering a time I was sure I'd stay a free and single guy. And I know that love can often be a tough and rocky climb, but you give me the strength and hope to try.
This love may not come easy, it may even hurt, I fear. But love, if you're for the having, I'm here, I'm here.
And that was This Love, written by Brett Christopherson, who's our guest today, from the new production, which is available to be viewed online by MU Theatre Department, called So Near, So Far. Brett, I read that you described your sense of humour as off the wall and dark. Does that come through in So Near, So Far? Are we living in times when our primary need is just to be uplifted and given joy?
Yeah, I'm not totally on board with that. I absolutely believe that we need to have hope, and we need to work towards a better future and all of that. But I mean, I don't know. I'm a fairly pessimistic person in my life. It doesn't always reflect in my work, though. But there is the song we've already referred to is fairly snarky and pessimistic, you know, with a wink at the audience. But you know. Yeah, my sense of humor can get kind of dark.
I would say that the song he's talking about, The Summer of Our Discontent, it's very uplifting to me because the three performers, they are singing what I think every single day. And so about the context that we're in. So it's this like, yes, we're in this together kind of feel, even through the snarkiness, which is hilarious. So it does both, I think, for sure.
So I was reading some research. There was some data collected back in May that showed that the top four things that people want from their arts organizations right now, they want to laugh and relax. They want to feel connected and stay connected. They want help with their kids. And they want a distraction from the real world. So I know this is kind of a crystal ball question, but what are MU Theatre Department's plan A and plan B for this fall semester? How can we laugh and relax with you?
Well, that's a great question. Our goal, you know, all the spaces that we did this summer was a reading. It was a workshop version. And so our goal is to get the show on its feet in a fully staged production. I don't know what that means yet. If I had to guess, if I had to look into my crystal ball and got an answer, I would say it will be staged and shared very similarly to how So Near, So Far was put together. So it would be recorded and then edited and put together and streamed, but it would be on stage and it would have sets and costumes and those kinds of things. Our top priority is to keep our students, our faculty and staff, and our audiences safe. And so I know that Dr. Carver, whatever the decision is, that will be the top priority. And to still give content and to still give ways that our audiences feel connected to the stories that we're telling.
Brett, are you already working on Pandemic the Musical?
No. I'm sure there are a bazillion people out there working on that already. Yeah. But I mean, to the point of like meat for creativity in these times, I do have a project in the works right now, which is a new development. So that's great.
Well, congratulations. That's awesome. I look forward to seeing it on a stage maybe someday.
Right?
So, Joy, how do people see So Near, So Far? They just go to your YouTube channel.
Yes, Mizzou Theater on the YouTube channel. It began on Wednesday at 7 p.m. and then it streams through Sunday, but we might extend it. We did that with all the spaces just because of the demand. So folks can just head there. And there is a link for donations. So if people feel so inclined, we would gladly accept their generosity. But it is definitely free and folks can watch it as many times as they want.
And as today is Friday, even though we record on Wednesday, it is actually Friday. So you can go to mutheatre@anytime.edu and click on the link through to see So Near So Far because it is already up online. Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Joy Powell and Brett Christopherson. I look forward to watching So Near So Far and seeing the new production of Brett Christopherson, whatever it is, whenever it is. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And that is it for today's show. Thank you so much for listening. The Speaking of the Arts theme music is courtesy of Yasmin Williams. I'll be back next week with more arts chat. So until then, stay arty, Columbia.